Hi, my name's Ali. This is the Rus Files Unite film podcast, where we discuss Russian films and films with a Russian connection. As always, I'm joined by a guest, and today my guest is Martin Kessler. Hi, Martin.
Hello. Thank you for letting me worm my way onto this podcast.
Thanks for coming on. So, Martin, before we get started, could you tell people a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a filmmaker. I'm also a podcaster, usually over at FlixWise, where I work as a producer on the main show, and I also have a spin-off now, the FlixWise Canada, where I talk about maybe a little bit more esoteric films. But the main show, it's going through the Sight and Sound list, the top 250 films supposedly ever made. So it's conversations about a lot of great films, even some Russian ones. So there's a little bit of overlap.
Yeah, it seems to be like Russia is, despite being super important in early-ish cinema, the country hasn't produced films particularly that are famous outside of Russia. I'd say like most people who are kind of like into films or semi into films will have heard of Tarkovsky and will have heard of Eisenstein.
Right.
Eisenstein, if you're doing a more Russian, Russified pronunciation. But yeah, kind of beyond that, at least for me, probably, unless you're properly into films, you're struggling to come up with more names than those two guys.
Right. That's sort of what I found. I don't like the silent era stuff as much. I like a lot of silent films, but the Russian films in particular haven't spoken to me as much. I don't know if that's a byproduct of having to watch Battleship Potemkin maybe a dozen times in film school. Like, that's not an exaggeration, but
yeah.
I've always sort of been more interested in the post-Stalin era films. Some of them I'd seen just through my father, who had watched them when they originally came out. Some I saw a little bit later on. I spent a semester at the Film Academy of Beijing, and they studied a lot of Russian films, Soviet films there, so it was kind of my big exposure, I think. I think it's funny going to China to learn about Russian film, but
because those two, after initially being like, hooray, we are communist brothers, they were kind of like in the mid-60s.
Yeah, there was a bit of a falling out, yeah.
Don't think you're doing communism properly. Well, we don't think you're doing communism properly.
Right. But that was the first place I'd actually seen a film that had to do with Alexei German, even though it wasn't actually, not now you wouldn't call it a Russian film. It's full of autor. It's a Kazakh film, sort of about medieval Kazakh civilization that was crushed under Genghis Khan. That was a really great film, which Alexei German and his wife wrote and direct. He didn't direct it, but he wrote and produced it. I don't think I even saw the whole thing. I think I saw an excerpt when they were talking about Ashes of Time. It was like during a lecture. So for years, I was thinking, oh, what's this sepia Genghis Khan movie? I kept trying to find it, and I didn't really find it until after Hard to Be a God came out, and I sort of dove into Alexei German's filmography, and then I saw all his films, I guess, everything he had something to do with. I immediately tried to seek them out, and I guess you didn't actually introduce the film yet. I'm sorry, I was like sliding into it, but
that's fine. No. So yes, because when we were talking about maybe doing a show together, you specifically, when I asked, which directors would you be interested in covering, you were like, Alexei German. I mean, like you, he wasn't somebody who was particularly on my radar, and this is going to be the first film of his I've actually seen. But it was like with you, sort of, although you obviously mentioned the Kazakh film that he co-wrote with his wife, it was Hard to Be a God that made me really aware that he was a director of significance, because I was still living in Moscow when that film came out. So I started seeing the posters for Trudna Buit Bogom, and just like, it's one of those titles where you kind of go, sorry for non-Russian speaking listeners, that's Hard to Be a God in Russian. That was kind of like, it's one of those titles where you go, that is an interesting title. I wonder what that's about. And I still haven't seen it to this day, but the way it's been described to me, it almost sounds like the film that Andrei Rublev would be if Tarkovsky was a nihilist who woke up in a bad mood all the way through the shoot, or something like that.
I mean, there's a lot of comparisons, especially to Andrei Rublev, but the more I kind of look at it, like, there's obviously a lot of overlap, but the just more different I find it is, and the more specific I find German's particular vision. You know, he was part of the same generation as Tarkovsky. He was a couple years younger, but essentially the same generation that came up with Larisa Shpietko and, you know, all those great filmmakers of that time period.
Sort of, and mid to late Soviet period, really.
Right.
Yeah.
So, like, I always think, you know, in some ways, The Heart to Be a God feels like the last gasp of that era of filmmaking, this sort of weird artifact from, you know, time when filmmakers like Tarkovsky still roamed the earth.
Yeah, because of course, Tarkovsky died pretty young, and Shapitko even younger. I mean, she was like 40.
She died young also. Yeah. You know, so there weren't that many peers at a certain point for German, and from what I could find, it seems like he was always very, well, maybe not always, but at a certain point, he was very, very highly regarded, but mostly within Russia, because I guess his films didn't get huge releases outside the country. I mean, Tarkovsky said that my friend Ivan Lapshin, the film we're going to be talking about, was the greatest Russian film ever made. People really respected him, and like, I think he's maybe more of a peer to Tarkovsky than somebody who's making film like in the tradition of Tarkovsky. You see, like, certain filmmakers, they try to emulate Tarkovsky, especially I think today, or people who are a little bit younger, or even like filmmakers who started off in the Soviet era, like Alexander Sukharov. You know, he had to do Days of Eclipse, which is kind of like his version of Stalker, or like, you know, they're kind of in some ways imitating what Tarkovsky did. And I think German, it sort of feels like, you know, not a descendant, but a cousin film to Andrei Rublev.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause he wouldn't have grown up watching Tarkovsky films. He would have been making his own films and, you know, probably hanging out with Tarkovsky from time to time, or, you know, going to similar, like, I mean, this is like revealing my spectacular ignorance about how the Soviet film industry works, but just, you know, they're your peers, as you say, rather than somebody,
I guess,
being like a successor.
Yeah, Tarkovsky was based in Moscow. You know, his first few films were for Mosfilm, and
sure.
Alexei German was in Leningrad, in St. Petersburg today. And I guess, like, after a while, they had, like, a phone correspondence. They wouldn't run into each other much in person, but they were telephone buddies at a certain point. And I think,
yeah, because back then, you couldn't just pick up and move city, you know, just because you felt like it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think sort of when Tarkovsky died, or even going a little bit earlier when he expatriated, it kind of left German with that title. Like, he sort of inherited the, you know, premier Russian filmmaking title, but, you know, he has very few films, even less than Tarkovsky, and I think they complement Tarkovsky's films as well. Mm. But you know, I keep telling people, like, oh, Alexei German, he's the other greatest Russian filmmaker. You know, there's Tarkovsky and there's German. They kind of go a little bit hand in hand, I think, if you watch their filmographies side by side. I think they actually almost interlock in a way that's sort of exciting to see. They kind of cover different aspects of
sort of similar topics, or
not just Russian life, but I think, like, part of the human experience, they're kind of coming at them from different perspectives. You know, I think Tarkovsky's more mystical and Alexei German's more corporeal. You know, he's interested in the body, but they both have sort of a poetic quality. They're both sort of, you know, even you could say a spiritual quality to their films. But I think in German, it's a little bit more rooted in human beings. You know, I think, like, maybe he's more of a humanist. You know, people will call Heart to Be a God nihilistic, but I think, like, it is sort of a strangely humanist film. I think he's just sort of somebody who doesn't shy away from the darker aspects of life, and he tries to show people in a very truthful way.
Yeah. So if we want to be super pretentious about it, we could almost call Tarkovsky like the Plato of like Soviet / Russian filmmaking, and German being more of a like a sort of Socrates.
Sure, we could go with that.
Not Socrates, Aristotle type figure. Sure. Just from what you've said, one being
that,
more
that works too. I'll go with that. Why not?
Yes. It's not a proper film discussion unless you bring some pretension in. Surely.
I know we're talking about Russian film. We got to up the pretentiousness.
Right.
I mean, not absolutely. As much as if we were talking about French film, but
Right. Yes. So this film specifically, Moi Druk Ivan Lapshin, my friend Ivan Lapshin. It's set in the Stalin era. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's sort of the beginning of the Stalin era. I think it goes from 1935 into 1936. When you watch it, it sort of goes into the new year a little bit. So it's just before the big purges, which I think is sort of key when watching the film. But this is going to be your first time watching it, right?
It is, yes.
Okay,
yeah,
I'm excited.
Little tiny bit of the initial setup, so I know that it's partly told as like a memoir or like somebody's memory, but I haven't got into the proper main action really. Although that's interesting that it has that framing device, because as I understand it, it's actually based on a novel by Alexei German's father Yuri. So
yes,
it's
very loosely based. I'll say I checked out the novel, and it takes a little bit from some of his other writings too, but Yuri German, his writing, I think it's much more rooted in sort of a pulpy romanticism. You know, he was a real, true believer, communist, even Stalinist in the era. And if you read some of the interviews with Alexei German, he talks a little bit about his father's writing because he's adapted it more than once. He's worked from his father's stories, but he's in some ways very critical. I think he's almost making a response to what his father was writing. He had sort of a complex relationship with his father. I think, he got along very well with him as a person, but was very, especially as he grew older, critical of his father's politics and also maybe just his artistic tendencies or his discipline as a writer. So it's almost the inverse of what you usually hear with like a creative father son or parent child pairings, where maybe they inspire them artistically but don't get along well at home, or like Hayao Miyazaki and his son Goro Miyazaki talking about things like that. But it's interesting to see how I think Alexei German sought to de-romanticize that era, because for a lot of people, like 1935-36, there's like this sentiment that existed, I guess, at the time when the film was made, and you still kind of hear that persist to this day, that some people say, well, the communism was inherently good, it was just corrupted either by Stalin or they sort of see it as a kind of fall from grace.
Yeah, it would have been fine, and then it went off the rails, and either that was Stalin's fault or that was somebody else's fault, but, basically you had a good thing that just didn't work out, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I've definitely encountered that sentiment quite a lot.
I think, this film sort of, part of the intent with it is to disprove that just by trying to show that time period as truthfully as possible by kind of pulling that, if you watch a film from that era, it's usually very glossy and romanticized, the way it depicts the period, the way people try to represent Russian life. I think German was very critical of some of the filmmakers who came up during that time, like Vertov, who's most famous for Man with a Movie Camera. And, he was a genius, but he also made a lot of propaganda films. He made a lot of sort of almost like newsreel type short films where, German said, I'm sure he's in some corner of Dante's hell. Like, he lied about everything about what life was like. So it's difficult to untangle that time period and try to get to what it was actually like. But that's one thing I find very interesting about this film. So I'm curious to see what you're going to think of it. I'm anxious.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the date that it was made, 1985, I was thinking, just knowing that it tackles the Stalin era and knowing that Garaman was not a true believer as far as like communism, just kind of thinking, how did he get this made? Because if it was made, 1986 or 1987, it's kind of like, okay, perestroika and glasnost are in full swing at this point, and you can basically say what you want about Stalin at that point. But in 1985, or before that, when you're pitching your film idea to the bosses at Lien Film and saying, okay, I'm going to make a film about the Stalin era, they're probably going to be like, what are you planning on saying?
Well, he got into trouble a couple of times with his previous films, and I think people knew to keep an eye on him. He had kind of a long-running feud with the head of the film guild at that time. So the film actually, he started working on it in 1979. And I know a big part of that was just to collect all the props that you see in the film and to work on the writing. But him and his wife, Svetlana Kamerlita, they were sort of, I think, deliberately deceptive in the screenplay. And, the film, it's constructed in such a way that you could mistake it for just sort of a slice of life type film without really understanding that you're meant to read in between the lines in a lot of cases.
Okay.
And it was completed, I'm not sure, sometime in the early 80s. And he was fired, and the film was shelved for a period of time. He was fired from Lien Film. And then I guess when Perestroika began, it was kind of pulled from the shelf and held up as an example of what it should be, sort of reflecting on the past. And that's kind of what saved it from total obscurity. Yeah. So it actually had quite a big release. I heard at the time there were lines around the blocks to see it. And it's a film that played on television quite often afterwards. And it even had some release outside Russia. It played in all the big film festivals, and kind of, Garman was never really that well known outside of Russia, but that was sort of the closest. He was on the Cannes Film Festival jury. He was on a lot of international, I guess, not press junkets, but you'd see him do talks, you'd see him
the
in
film
New York,
circuit.
He sort of did the film circuit, and for a little while it seemed like, maybe he would be better known. And then he just kind of ended up in this long period of time where his projects kind of kept being derailed. He tried to make Hard to Be a God in the late 80s, and that ended up being made as an East German film production instead. He tried to do a film based on The Black Arrow, and that fell apart. He tried to do a film based on, I don't know if you know the author, Eugene Schwartz, who does the fairy tales.
No.
Okay. He was the famous fairy tale author. He did the 1940s Cinderella.
Okay.
But German, I guess he spent a summer with him as a child when his father was in some political trouble. And he tried to do a version of one of Schwartz's most famous plays, The Dragon, which was sort of a fantasy story that was also allegory for fascism, totalitarianism, communism. And that actually has a lot of similarities to Hard to Be a God. And that also ended up being directed by somebody else. So he had a few projects that just didn't get off the ground. And then the film that followed it up, the Krushalia My Car, that's at the end of the Stalin era. And that film was sort of made in the post-Soviet era when he had trouble getting funding, so he would shoot it in bits and pieces over years and years, so it ended up only being released in 1998. And then on top of that, but the release was botched, so I think just that gap of time between 1984-85, when My Friend Ivan Lapshin was coming out, and 14 years until his follow-up film, just he kind of disappeared in a lot of people's minds, I think, and never really reemerged until Hard to Be a God, which was released after his death.
Yeah, because I think when it came out, it was kind of like, it would say on posters, the late, last masterwork of the recently deceased great filmmaker. Yeah, and as you were saying, like, it's if you're not producing a film every two, three, four years,
right?
Kind of like, because everyone else is churning out so many films, it's easy to kind of get forgotten. And especially if you're, you know, someone like Tarkovsky, or just, you know, just anyone who's once they've passed, you can kind of make your decision about them being like, are they a great filmmaker or not, rather than them being like, you know, they've produced some great stuff, but what have they done recently?
Exactly. I mean, you can look at their filmography as a whole, and certain, even flawed films become easier to contextualize. Like, I was thinking about Kurosawa. I just recorded an episode of the High and Low podcast, which...
Oh, awesome.
Those guys are great. But we talked about Dodeska Den, which is my least favorite Kurosawa film, and it came at a time when he was having a lot of trouble. Like, it was 5 years after his previous film, Redbeard, and 5 years until his follow-up film, which was filmed in Russia. So, you know, I was saying, I think Kurosawa had a suicide attempt after the film had been finished. Yeah. And I said, you know, if he had died, then that would have been the great filmmaker who made that kind of weird out of touch one at the very end. But because he lived and he continued to make films, and you can sort of look at where his career went, you say, oh, Dodeska Den, that's, you know, his first color film. And I see where his direction of color goes with these painterly films, Ran and Kagumusha and Dreams. And you can sort of forgive a lot knowing where he goes later in his career. So it does make a big difference sometimes, being able to look at a filmmaker in hindsight, even though, you know, it's a little bit cruel to artists to only sort of say, well, now that you're dead, I can make my decision about you.
Yeah. Turns out you were great. Shame you're not around to say that.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we should probably watch the film.
Sounds good.
So as we always do, I get my guest to speak a little bit of Russian. And the word we say is poyekhali.
Poyekhali.
Yes, which is what Yuri Gagarin said when he was blasting off to become the first man in space.
All right.
Okay, so 3, 2, 1. Poyekhali. And welcome back. We've just watched my friend Ivan Lapshin. And before we get to discussing the movie, Martin's going to give us a quick summary of the plot. So this is the spoiler alert section. If you haven't seen it yet and don't want to know what happens, pause the podcast and go watch it. It's only an hour and a half and it's on YouTube, so that should be easily done. Okay, right. Over to you, Martin.
Okay. So the film's set in 1935 over to 1936. Although there's a framing device in present-day 1980s of a narrator reflecting back on their childhood. Their childhood self is a character in the film, but not really an essential character. They're more like an observer. They live in the same flat as the main character, Ivan Lapshin, sort of across the hall from him. And he's a detective from Leningrad who's moved out into this a little bit more provincial city, town. And he's been tasked with tracking down this gang who's been selling illegal meat. It doesn't explicitly say it, but I think it's pretty strongly implied that they're selling dead people for food. As I guess a little bit of a echo of the 1932-33 famine. So while that's going on, he's also getting a crush on this actress, Natasha, who's in a play that's coming up. He promises he's going to help her research the role. And there's a bunch of other characters who kind of come and go. It's a lot of slice of life type stuff. I don't know if anybody has seen Edward Yang's films, but I'm a little bit reminded of that when you watch all these threads kind of interwoven. But the crime plot and the love triangle plot are sort of the two big elements, I guess. And the way they fit together kind of gives you this portrait of the character of Ivan Lapshin. He's pitched as our local Pinkerton. You know, I think he's a little bit of a Bulldog Drummond gone communist. He's kind of a dork, I think. You know, like, He's trying to win the affections of Natasha, but you can tell she's not really into him. And, you know, he has this sort of romantic ideal of a relationship that eventually gets shot down after the opening night of her play, which kind of bombs, with her role in particular being panned. You know, he climbs up to her window and confesses his love to her, and she says, "No, I'm actually in love with your friend Kanan instead, who is a writer whose wife recently died, and he's suicidal, so he's moved in with Ivan Lapshin." So, feeling dejected and a little bit bitter, Ivan Lapshin closes in on the gang. There's a big raid in which his friend Kanan gets his stomach burst, and Ivan Lapshin shoots the gang leader in cold blood. Everyone says their goodbyes, and that's the surface level story, but I think there are a lot of things going on under the surface which we'll get into, but that's more or less the sequence of events, right?
Yeah, that's very succinct. Yeah, because I was thinking, yeah, if you just go through it scene by scene, if you describe it that way, it sounds kind of like an incoherent mess, because like you say, if you just, it's slice of life, and if you just took a fairly random year out of somebody's life and just, you know, dropped somebody in as an observer, it probably wouldn't make a lot of sense, because you and especially when you can't just kind of like take somebody aside and go, what's going on now here?
Right. It's a little like watching two films at once, sometimes stacked on top of each other.
Yeah.
And a lot of it feels incidental while you're watching it. A lot of the dialogue just it's people just talking, but
yeah,
you watch it, like I think you can still come away with a lot just on one viewing, but I think it's definitely a film that rewards multiple viewings, and you can kind of pick apart the meaning behind some of these little details that seem incidental at the time or just a part of everyday life at the time when you're watching.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I need some more like thinking time with the film. I finished it,
right,
and I was kind of like, oh, I mean, I found as I was watching it, I was thinking, this is interesting, but I don't know where it's going, because you keep switching from, you know, one little bit of the plot of the, you know, those two main plots to something that's, yeah, more incidental, and, you know, just some of the police guys like messing around in a room, or just, you know, walking from just kind of on the beat, almost like going around the town. It's interesting your take on the Lapshin character, because I thought he was quite authoritative in some ways.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he kind of reminds me of, like, thought before, he has the aura of a high school basketball coach, you know? He's sort of, you know, the word people would maybe use to describe him now, or the phrase is white knight, you know? He's somebody who's got his ideals, but, you know, the kind of consequence of that is he has that authoritarian streak, like you mentioned. And, you know, I keep thinking, like, it's sort of funny the way he tries to flirt with Natasha. I think he's very bad at it, you know, where she talks about, like the theater director yelled at me, and he says, well, I'll put him in his place, you know. It's his way of trying to be flirtatious, you know. I'll defend you, I'll do what's right. And it's very unattractive, I find, you know. And you can kind of see that gap, like he's doing everything in his own mind correct, you know. He's a product of his time, and he's gonna be righteous and do the right thing, and he has his ideals, and things don't work out for him. You know, he sort of feels like that the world should be moving towards this utopia. He keeps saying, well, we'll clear the land of scum and build an orchard. That becomes his catchphrase, almost.
Yeah, he uses that a few times, and it's kind of like, and the way you see he's going about it, and if you just know any Soviet history, it's like, that's going to be really bad.
Yeah, like, I think, I mean, you can talk about the specifics of the film in relation to Russia's history and to the specifically communist ideology, but I think in a broader sense, for me, it's a film about unexamined romantic ideals. I think it's about being able to, in some ways, see yourself in that time period and kind of understand the lack of foresight, the lack of reflection, and the really horrible consequences that it'll have. You know, it's sort of funny, like at the very beginning of the film, when he's just hanging out and he's being introduced to all these people, they say, hey, our local Pinkerton, you know, the star of many an adventure, Ivan Lapshin, that's how he's introduced.
Yeah.
You know,
And people are quite admiring.
They're quite admiring. Somebody asks him, oh, what's the psychology of killers? And he just sort of says simply, well, they're killers. Like, you know, there's good guys and there's bad guys. And by the end of the film, you know, you see he's a killer. And yeah. You understand what his psychology is leading up to that. So I think it's a really interesting, insight into why certain ideals of human nature fail. You know, I think why we fail when we try to be good or try to reach our ideals sometimes, how those can have negative consequences when we don't really understand ourselves.
Well, and the whole, you know, the end always justifies mm-hmm. the means. I mean, personally, I think that's almost, that attitude is almost the definition of evil.
Right.
Because if you're the kind of like, have the attitude of, well, if it gets the job done, then you can do whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. That's going to have some terrible consequences.
The film, like, it's, there's a lot of optimistic sentiment in the film, you know, oh, by 1937, we're going to have this. By 1938, champagne production's going to be up to this. And, like, you just know it's going to get worse. You know, like, this is supposed to be the ideal period of, you know, of the Soviet Union. Like, Alexei German said that before he set out to make the film, he was kind of forewarned about criticizing, you know, 1934, 35, you know, when around the time the film was set, because apparently he was told, well, Stalin was bad, but those years were beyond reproach. Those were good years under communism. And like he finished that anecdote by just kind of looking into camera and saying, there were no good years under communism. Yeah. Like the very end of the film when his, not Kanin, but the other friend, Okoshkin,
yes.
He says it was just a bad year when they're kind of reflecting on everything. And like,
yeah,
that, you know, it seems like a very simple statement, but that's such a bold sentiment to come from a film from this time period in this context, you know, that very, you know, daring in a very understated way. Like, I think some filmmakers, the tendency would be more to kind of make things extra bad and make things terrible in this reign of terror. But what's sort of maybe more effective is just how casual everything is in it and how kind of like you have bad years sometimes, but you don't expect that it's going to go from bad to cataclysmic, right?
Yeah. I can imagine if you see this film, you know, without knowing much of the context, especially if you don't know the significance of like 35, 36, and especially the year following, 37 was like the real height of the Stalinist purges. You'd kind of be like, maybe not, you know, what's the big deal? But like, yeah.
Right. A lot of international critics, I think, didn't pick up on that. You know, I was reading some criticism from when the film came out. You know, you had people like Jonathan Rosenbaum sort of praising the authenticity in the costumes and the performances, but kind of shrugging when it came to any sort of thematic interpretation. He just didn't, I think, understand the context. And I mean, it doesn't take much context, you know. I think I don't know if it's like a lack of education, but you know, if the film were set in Germany in 19, you know, in the same year, say 1935, 36, and you know, we're looking at a group of Jewish characters, like, I think most international audience would recognize, oh, they're in the first act of a Holocaust film, even if they don't realize it. You know, you kind of don't realize you're in a film about, you know, an atrocity when you're just moving along at the pace of life. So I think that's one of the tricks of the film, is just how it seems slice of life, but it's building up to something more, something darker.
Yeah, there's a really clever little cut that they do. I marked it as being like 14-15 minutes in, and basically Ivan wakes up in the middle of the night kind of in a cold sweat, and he's quite upset, and the scene plays out, and he just says, you know, I've just got to go somewhere. And then the cut is, you hear, like, it sounds like 3 or 4 gunshots. And then the next scene, you're going into an orchestra, like like a band being struck up. So initially, because I knew this was a film set in this period, I'm like, is it just going to cut to him having just killed some people, or, you know, something more explicit? And it's kind of like, okay, I think I'm still supposed to take that he's been out in the night and, you know, done something like that. But it's kind of like, it's almost, if you're not watching for it, you'll miss it. But it does sound like gunshots and then a band, you know?
There's quite a few things like that in the film that you could miss on first viewing, or, you know, miss without a little bit of context. Like, what's sort of funny is the film's sense of humor. I find it quite a funny film. But a lot of the jokes are implying something more than just, you know, a little bit of levity. Like, there's quite a few jokes about reporting on people.
Oh, yeah, I'll be taken away.
I'll say that you ate your husband, I'll have you sent off. You know, and, you know, it's sort of understood that the gulags are already in place. You know, I think some people assume it just kind of started in 1937, but the gulag system was already in existence at this time. And, you know, at the very end, like, there's the prostitute that Natasha has Ivan introduce her to research her role in the play. She's playing a prostitute, you know, and at the end, you know, she's sent off to a gulag. You know, it's sort of, they don't think too much of it, but, like, you know, in not much time, most of these characters are going to end up in the same place.
Yeah, most likely.
I mean, Alexei Garman said the reason why he cast the actor plays Ivan Lapshin, Andrei Boltnev, he said it's as if he had the seal of death on his face. Like, you just know this guy's not going to make it through it all. He's just doomed in some way.
I've seen that quote as well.
And I mean, like, in some ways he was maybe correct about the actor, because he died quite young. I think he was 49. He had a stroke and just killed over not long after the film. Yeah, a couple of years after the film was made. He had a couple other roles, but you know, there is just something doomed, you know, when you see him, like, especially, you know, when he wakes up at night, and, like, later on you find out that he was a veteran from the Civil War, and he still has post-traumatic stress, and it was never really dealt with.
Yeah, I mean, that whole, going into the, like, late 80s, 1990s, even now, like, post-traumatic stress is not something that people have found very effective ways to treat, but at least they try at this point, whereas back then it was just like, yeah, you were in the war, yeah, fine.
I mean, a lot of the time it wasn't even acknowledged. Like, I was talking to somebody not that long ago about like, all the people coming back with post-traumatic stress from you know, recent wars in the world, and they were like, well, like, that isn't that weird that, you know, not that many people from World War II had post-traumatic stress. And I said, like, I'm pretty sure they did. It just wasn't talked about or addressed or dealt with. You know, like, there's that John Huston documentary, I think it's called Let There Be Light, which was about American soldiers with post-traumatic stress. But, like, it was really rare to see that, you know, even in like, 1980s, when this film was made, to even see that really talked about openly or understood. So that,
yeah,
there's a number of things like that where, you know, in the film it's just dealing with, you know, real issues, even if they were taboo.
Yeah, I almost don't know where to
Well, I'm curious, like, how did you find that the representation of the time period? Like, I think, again, you know, looking at a lot of the films set in this time or made in this time, they tend to be very idealized, romanticized. Like, to me, this felt like one of the most, not necessarily realist, because, like, you know, the social realist style, that's a whole nother thing. This film isn't in the social realist style, but it felt like the most natural or authentic representation of the time period I'd ever seen on film. You know, it feels like somebody just took a camera and went back in time. A lot of the shots are handheld. It feels very organic, you know, and Garman has this technique, which he's sort of developed and built upon throughout his career, of having people glance into camera, and that's usually, you know, a big no-no. That they say it's gonna, you know, break the fourth wall, the illusion that you're watching a movie. And it's not done like a documentary, you know, it's not done like an episode of The Office where it's meant to be as if there's a camera crew really there filming, but still, like, he never really pretends that the camera isn't there. It's a very strange, almost contradictory approach, but I find it reinforces that reality so much, feeling like these people could just glance into camera, and it feels like you're, in some way, you know, meant to reflect on these people. Like, it's a mirror, almost, that they're staring at you and you're staring at them.
Yeah. I mean, I was interested just in terms of the way that the camera gets in really, really close, and you kind of think, like, that must be really quite hard to act around.
Yes.
Just from a practical, but it doesn't, you know, credit to the actors, they you don't really get the sense that it's impeding them from doing their work, but it is. Yeah, you think how that must take some getting used to, and as you say, yeah, you do have the occasional, like, yeah, people glancing into the camera. I mean, I didn't notice too many times, but yeah, certainly Ivan does it a few times, and I'm like, that is sure. Odd. You don't see that.
I mean, there's a couple of, like, people on the streetcar. One just stares in through the window, or, you know, somebody walking through the crowd at the end of the film just stops and turns. Like, sometimes just strangers, even not even the main characters always. You know, it's unusual, but I find it really, really effective. You know, you sort of have this immediate attachment to these people. I think the way Gurman explained his research process for the film, I think it probably came from... like footage of the time period. He said because he didn't really trust archives and researching, he went through a lot of oral history, a lot of atypical research sources. So he said, you know, for instance, they would watch footage of people putting up, you know, maybe telephone wire or pipes, you know, that was only incidentally capturing people because that showed people in their everyday life, I guess, in a way that wasn't posing for a camera or acting to a camera or wasn't arranged. And people would look into camera. And I think a little bit of it comes from that. You know, it has that feeling that, you know, most of the time people just sort of ignore that it's there. But every once in a while, somebody just kind of can't help but look over. You know, I think I would have the same, you know, type of footage if I went to downtown Toronto and just set up a camera and started filming without really drawing attention to myself. I think it would look a little bit like that.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I've done a little bit of photography in events where, you know, you're wanting to get close-ups of people, and yeah, you just have to kind of keep moving along before people sort of notice that you're there,
right? But I it's strange because it's all rehearsed, it's all arranged, you know. So it's this very intricate reconstruction to give you the impression of something spontaneous. You know, there's a lot of spontaneous moments in the film that are, of course, carefully orchestrated, so it's, you know, it's sort of antithetical to the documentary process, but I find you get that kind of authenticity that, you know, you would if maybe somebody could have really made this film back then. You know No film looks like this from that period, or really any period, but that's the feeling I have is, oh, you know, if somebody took a camera back in time, this is maybe what they would come up with.
Yeah, I would definitely like to see that his approach to shooting that subject applied to different different, you know, times and places, just because, yeah, I, like you say, it does feel sort of like watching a documentary, but not, like you said.
Right. I mean, it's very unusual in Hard to Be a Goat because that's science fiction film. It's this sort of medieval reality where, like, I've heard a lot of people comment, oh, it was like being on another planet, you know, and it has that kind of documentary, almost sense of authenticity, but you're watching a constructed reality, a constructed epoch, not something that was ever real, you know, so it's a really... kind of a jarring effect where, you know, you're watching something fantastical, but it feels so real. So
it's from, of course, anything from the pre-photographic era where you can't even, you know, go and look at photos from the time period and reconstruct it. You're just totally going from, you know, artistic interpretations and written sources. Yeah, because anything from that time is always presented in a certain way, like a more sort of, I guess, epic style.
Yeah, this isn't epic at all. It's totally intimate. You know, Gurman's approach, it's, like you said, often very close up, almost too close. You know, his framing tends to be very, very tight. You know, he goes for intimacy. It's like he's trying to show you less, and the frame feels very compacted. There's a lot of visual information. There's photographs in the background. There's several layers of people. It tends to feel very... cramped, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I found that I would get more out of this from repeated watching, partly just because my levels of Russian aren't as good as I would like them to be, and a lot of the time you have multiple characters talking at once. And and so, you know, the subtitles, which, you know, for this YouTube version aren't superb.
No.
but they're given a very difficult task, because in a more like traditionally made film, you don't have people talking over each other. But then that's one of the, I guess, one of the other characteristics of the film that make it seem so lifelike, is that in real life that totally does happen.
Right. It does capture those rhythms of life, but like you said, it's quite an intricate soundscape, and I think that's another reason why Germán's films have had difficulty finding an audience outside of Russia, is they're notoriously difficult to subtitle. I don't mind dubbing. I almost think if somebody had a lot of resources at their disposal, they should do a very good dub of the film, because I think that might actually better represent what's going on than trying to subtitle everything. You know, you always lose something in the performances, but I think, you know, that sense of people talking over each other, people bursting into song, and the radio's playing in the background, and you know, sometimes you do just catch this snippet of something that you realize is actually important, or tells you something crucial, or gives you insight into what's going on, or this world, you know. But I think it's interesting that the narrator, it's them thinking back to their childhood, because it almost makes me think of, you know, when you're a kid and you're surrounded by adults, how much goes over your head. It made me feel a little bit like that, saying, oh well, like I understand that I don't get everything, I'm just going to try to get as much from context as I can and try to follow along. And you know, later, maybe further down the line, you know, like the characters looking back with hindsight, you know, if I go back and rewatch the film again, maybe I can understand more, I can get more of a grasp, you know, maybe even more than what the characters have of themselves. You know, they don't realize that anything they're saying might be significant, but you might when you watch it a second time.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of things in hindsight, like right at the beginning of this part, you mentioned the thing about the implication is that the gang are, you know, selling human meat as meat and passing it. As soon as you said that, I was kind of like, yes, that makes so, now that you say that, that makes so much more sense of some of the things that I've seen. Especially like there's one scene where they go into this kind of like, it's kind of like a bunker or a cellar. It's not in the bottom of a house though. It's out to the open, and they talk about witnesses, and you have these bodies coming out. And I was kind of like, okay, so that's, you know, that's been murders that was committed by the gang, but I didn't quite know where they fit in the jigsaw.
And then later, the accomplice they arrest, he's a butcher.
You
know, so like it's all, you know, insinuations. Yes. You know, I think
right, and he and he's constantly saying, "I didn't know anything." And Lapshin's basically like, you know, I'm gonna hang you like a dog, and he just like, but I didn't know what was going on. I didn't realize I was, yeah, that, oh my goodness.
Yeah, I think the word he uses, it's like a word for beef, and then the word or the phrase Lapshin uses, it's like illegal meat, which is very peculiar. But I, you know, it's full of things like that where, oh, there's more going on here than meets the eye. I think it's a film that you can kind of keep coming back to and finding more layers in, and that's one reason why I've really fallen in love with it. It's like, you know, for an hour 35 minute film, it feels like just infinitely dense and complex. You know, you can kind of keep pulling things out of it, and just the construction of it is so elegant. You know, I mean, it like you said, it's difficult to maybe summarize, but for a film that addresses all these things, that has elements of purges and gulags and famine just kind of rolled into something that feels so simple on the surface, I think it's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, that's, people say, you know, brevity is the soul of wit, and getting all that much into like you say, a 90-minute film, and doing it, covering the sort of ground that, you know, you might have to, you know, other directors would take 2.5 hours.
Yeah, or more. I mean, there's a film, I don't know if you know the Torpedo Bombers, was a film that came out before Ivan Lapshin was released, but it was written by Alexei German and his wife. I think German did have a screenwriting credit, because it was like while he was fired after Lapshin was completed. And that was directed by
director Aronovich, Semyon Aronovich. And after that, they had like a little bit of like a soft falling out. Aronovich went and made this film, Confrontation, which is like a 6-hour long. I think it's kind of a ripoff of Ivan Lapshin, if you see it. I don't think it's as good. Mm. And also it's 6 hours long, but like, you know, it has the black and white and color. It has, you know, some similar elements, people looking to the camera. It even stars the same actor who plays Ivan Lapshin, Boltnev, you know, so it's yeah. Like, I think he was trying to do the same thing, and it just came out as this like 6-hour long mess. If you ever see, or I don't want to be too unfair to it. Like just in contrast to Ivan Lapshin, yeah. I think like you see, oh, like it can go badly. It doesn't necessarily yeah. have to work out in this sort of perfectly constructed way. It can be this sort of sprawling, endlessly sprawling thing that goes through, you know, years and years and says a lot without actually saying that much.
Yeah. So, if people have enjoyed this Alexei German film, where would you direct them next?
In terms of German's filmography, I think maybe the film that makes the most sense to watch after this is Krustelia Maikar, which is about the end of the Stalinist period, and it's not more on the nose, but like just being made in the post-Soviet period, German could deal sort of more openly with the purges, with Stalinism. Like it's about the doctor's plot.
Sort
of mentioned, like I think in the episode about the Death of Stalin film.
Yes, I was going to say, if people have seen that, that's right. Yes, that's featured in. Yeah.
You know, it's basically about this Jewish doctor who gets pulled into the doctor's plot, you know, without really realizing what's happening while it's happening. It's just, you know, like, it's easy to look up on Wikipedia now and understand what it is. But at the time, it was just this sort of nightmare he gets sucked into and he's sent off. The film actually shows the gulags, which, you know, even today, that's sort of rare to see on film.
Yeah.
And he gets pulled back to treat Stalin on his deathbed. And it's this great sort of high and low kaleidoscopic depiction of life under Stalin at that time. And it's so, in some ways, it's so different from Ivan Lapshin. Like, all that optimism's gone and it's just replaced with this total paranoia. It's a very different atmosphere, but they juxtapose one another in very interesting ways. His first two solo directed films are war films that pair together well. Trial on the Road and 20 Days Without War. One's sort of more about civilian life. It's actually a love story. And the other one, it's about a Russian soldier who was fighting on the German side during World War II. And then switches sides and joins up with the partisans. But it's very morally complex film that it was banned for 15 years. So that one wasn't seen as much. But that was a big inspiration for Come and See and The Ascent, which are considered like the two big Soviet war films, basically, or at least two of the biggest ones.
Yeah, to watch for this podcast.
You know, it's I think a lot of people are coming at his career right now from Hard to Be a God, because that was most recent, and it's like in some ways it's very seductive. This science fiction medieval film where you're wondering what is it even, but I think it's sort of a culmination of his work, and it's almost easier to build up to that one because German's style becomes more and more extreme with every film. You can kind of see his very first film, which he was a co-director on. It didn't have much control. It's more in that Soviet realist style. It's actually pretty typical. Like, it's not, and he called it a disaster. I think it's just like a mediocre film, the Seventh Companion, you know. And then after that, he starts deviating quite strongly, and he ran into lots of censorship issues because he kept addressing difficult subjects. But, you know, he was very interested, I think, in history. And by the time you get to Hard to Be God, like, it's almost an allegory for history. You know, it's a complex film, but I think it helps if you watch his other films first. You get more of a sense of where he's coming from than trying to approach it maybe through the science fiction genre, because I find that's not the most effective way to get the most out of that film, you know?
Cool. Well, definitely, it's whetted my appetite to see, more of what he's done. And just to, I guess, read more about his about his approach, because I went in with this one sort of like deliberately as almost as ignorant as possible, just so that so I'd kind of draw my own conclusions. But
I mean, you've been watching a couple of these Soviet films, some from right around this time. Like, how do you find it stacks up to, you know, some of the contemporary films, contemporaneous films?
I mean, I guess the one that springs most to mind is, it's actually, you know, just after the end of the Soviet Union, but the Yuri Mamin Window to Paris. I know that sounds like a weird comparison, because that's a fantasy and it's not in this right. In the Stalin era, but just, I don't know, there's something about the sense of humor in those two films is mm-hmm. is quite similar in
like there's stuff in Ivan Lapshin, like the wallpaper with the hammer and sickles, like some of it's I'm sure it's from something that really existed, but it reads like funny. It's just,
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of, I mean, we didn't get too much into it, but there are a lot of jokes in Ivan Lapshin, or just like funny moments. You know, there's you know, when Natasha, the actress, is saying, "Oh, I'm going to be hit as the prostitute," and Ivan Lapshin says, "Yes, you are," and then kind of looks off after realizing what he just said.
Yeah,
you know, there's a lot of things like that. You know, I find, you know, maybe I don't know if it's like specifically Russian sense of humor, but I find it very funny. And like, there is a sort of
gallows-y, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite dark sometimes. And comparing it to a fantasy, like, I think even though the film is very rooted in reality, in history, there's also this sort of parable quality to it. I think many of German's films do have this feeling that you're watching something reduced to the point of parable, or simplified to that point of allegory or parable, you know, where you have a very simple story that you can pull a lot of meaning out of. And like, even within the film, there's sort of mini parables. I thought it was funny, the experiment with the fox in the rooster, where, you know, that the child is guarding them, saying no smoking around the animals.
Oh, yes.
You know, first time I watched it, I thought, like, is that just the most pathetic zoo in the world, or what's going on? But it's meant to be like this experiment to show that, well, if the fox is fed, you know, him and the rooster will be friends, actually. But then the fox eats the rooster. So, you know, to me, you know, what that says is, you know, even if the fox is fed, he'll still be a killer. You know, you'll still have Cain's and Abel's in paradise, I think. So, you know, even something like that, you can find a lot of meaning in. So it's just a very rich film in that regard.
Yeah, and the kid's response is brilliant. It's like, I'm paraphrasing, but it's something like, we've run into a snag with the experiment, but research will continue. And it's like, it's just really funny hearing that from like a 12-year-old.
Right.
Because that's totally what, you know, like the official government spokesman would say, or like, you know.
Yeah.
Just going back to the humor, the first thing that you see when you're, you know, after the, like, the 1980s like memory bit that kind of bookends the film is this bunch of guys in the police station kind of like reenacting an air raid.
I guess Italian World War One fighters making all the sounds.
I guess this is them taking, you know, based on news reports of the Spanish Civil War, I guess.
Right. The Spanish Civil War, right.
Yeah, and it's quite funny to watch a bunch of grown men doing that, but then you kind of think about, you know, when it's kids doing it, they're kind of innocent of like how horrible war is, but these are grown men who probably have a good idea of what it's actually like, especially as, you know, most of them would have been young men during the Civil War and probably seen some action with that. So that's kind of like, it's funny, but it's creepy and weird at the same time.
Right. I even wondered if that triggers Lapshin's first episode where he wakes up in the night. I think he mentions that he had a nightmare about airplanes.
Yeah, it's an interesting reading of that. Yeah, definitely. In general, like, wrapping back to the theme of people in this film aren't necessarily really thinking very hard about what they're doing and what effect it might have on people. Awesome. I feel like
I think it's a film we could talk about endlessly, but I think we sort of touched on the you know, quite a bit for first viewing. I think people are you know, either going to be interested and go out and see it, or maybe stay away. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, on paper, it's not the easiest sell. A mostly black and white film about the, you know, the period of the Stalinist purges. And it's you know, to the.
I mean, it's hard for me to tell. I don't think it's as inaccessible as its reputation suggests, or like I think it's difficult for me to say, but I don't think it's as intimidating as sometimes you hear it discussed as. I think German sort of built up this reputation. Some people have even called his films non-narrative, which I think is just untrue. You know, I think film comments sort of just characterize them that way, but you know, I think especially for, you know, American audiences or a lot of Western audiences, it's talked about as kind of films where, oh, a bunch of stuff happens. I don't know. I think it can be a little bit scary, not completely understanding what's happening all the time, but it's exciting too, and funny and charming and very warm. And, you know, I think as critical it is of this time period and these characters, you know, you're meant to watch them with a critical eye, but also a loving eye. You know, I think it's, at the end of the day, it's a very compassionate film in its own way.
Yeah, because I mean, that's definitely reinforced that that's the director's intention, like with the kind of the book in end at the end. He even talks about it at the beginning of this.
Says it's
well.
His declaration, like, of love to these people, you know, and says it's going to be a sad tale. Yeah.
Yeah, but I had an issue with the translation with that, because it says declaration, but the Russian word that he uses is объяснение, which I always understand as explanation, which a declaration of love doesn't sound like, it sounds passionate and, you know,
right,
emotion driven, but not, you know, not of, there's not much like rational substance. Whereas
an articulation of
somebody,
love or
yeah,
I don't know.
Whereas I know, as a translation, explanation of love sounds weird because it's not a collocation that we have,
right?
But it does, like, it does convey that, like, okay, to for you to get this, it's gonna take some time.
Yeah, right. That's a good point to add. And yeah, it's sort of funny looking at that way. Like, again, you know, people can, it's like sort of strange actually that people watch the film and come away saying, well, it's pretty nihilistic or it's dark, but like there's definitely love there. And, you know, maybe it does need a bit explaining, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. So before we go, is there anything that you would like to direct people towards, Martin?
Sure. If people want to hear more of me at all, not sure why, but you can check out flixwise.com, where I have a lot of great film conversations. It's I'm biased, but I think it's a very good podcast. And if folks have Twitter, they can follow me at Movie Kessler, and I tweet a lot about movies. I don't know, Alexei German, or, you know, other movies too, maybe movies that more people have seen. I guess that's it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Martin. I really appreciated the insight that comes from watching that multiple times, and, you know, having just like literally come off the film and not really had time to kind of sit with it.
I know. I was wondering what your reaction was going to be like. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me on. I feel really lucky to be on this show and be on this episode in particular, and hopefully we'll have another conversation at least before too long.
Awesome. Thanks again. Okay. That's all for today, folks. Das Vidania. Hello again. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Roost Files Unite podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, I'd love to hear from you. So, there's a couple of different ways you can do that. There's a Roost Files Unite Facebook group you can join. We're on Twitter at RusFilesU. That's RusFiles with the letter U at the end. We're on Instagram at RusFiles_unite. And you can also email at RusFilesUnite@gmail.com. Also, if you can spare a couple of minutes to rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, that will help other people hear about the show and would be very much appreciated. Thanks again for listening, and goodbye.